interesting presentation. I'm just getting a bit. There's some kind of. I might be wrong, but there is some kind of I get a feeling that in term using or searching for lexical terms, there's some kind of a legislative process in both sides. What Stephen is saying and what you're saying. I mean, my discomfort lies at two levels with the attention economy. I mean, what Stephen describes is a typical bazaar scene. I mean, why? I mean, like, you know, people hawking for attention, five people with the same wares, whoever catches your eye first gets it. Now, what's the problem with that? That's the way in which bazaar economies work. Maybe capitalism is being converted into a bazaar economy. If for from an Indian point of view, we could put it just simply that the dynamics of capitalism have produced a certain relationship between consumer and producer, which forces capitalism to go to the level of the bazaar and still cover its tracks by showing that I'm still the old centralized capitalistic order and things like that. Now, therefore, the attention economy is very much part of other cultures' ways of doing commerce, and these questions have not necessarily been framed in these ways. It would be interesting to see what Indian economic thinking has had to say about attention economies and how the bazaar has thought through this logic of competition within its own terms, because then we start to look at things in a different way. So therefore, the logic is that, you know, I mean, the problem of using a metaphor like light and shadow, that is static, you know, I mean, whereas a bazaar and attention economies are organic. So say, for example, if I am in a bazaar and I'm looking at competitors, there are more successful competitors than less successful competitors. But there are ways in which less successful competitors will do then various kind of strange things in order to gain social prestige. For example, if I'm unsuccessful at my business, then I might start a little temple on the side to kind of get economy. So therefore, it's an organic process by which attention economies' shadows are producing different routes by which they are staking a claim within. So this shadow is not necessarily about us deciding the level of attention or inattention, but the shadows themselves are producing their own ways of getting attention. So it's not that people in the shadow are not inattention. They just produce it in different terms, different from the ways in which art history or institutions would like to look at them. So that's one of the problems that I'm facing with this discussion about attention and shadow. I don't think the shadow is that problematic in terms of attention. And about your project, the thing is that, again, it comes down to a bazaar space. I mean, I would really be interested in seeing it from the other point of view, stakeholding, risk-taking, but from your own participation, what it does to you as a participator. That's the more interesting bit for me, actually, rather than seeing what's happening with these people, because that's where actually the stakes are, because you are inserting yourself into possibly a very different trajectory of life than what your parents would have deemed for you or what society would legislate for you. You're taking a detour and going into a certain space. And again, for me, the bazaar is a space where these kinds of things happen in a very strange way, and there are histories of people doing interesting things in the bazaar, coming from different backgrounds, but being able to change the bazaar precisely because they decide to change tracks in their life and take on something which they have not done. And I would be interested in your kind of that, to reframe the entire kind of thing. So that's, so then that it's no longer about legislating their practice, describing what you are doing, but saying what I am doing in this space as a human being and in these practices. I mean, that's a kind of
change their conditions of production or even their life circumstances, you too are being changed. So it's a two-way process. It's not just about you going and working with the marginalized. It also does something to your subjectivity as well. So that's why when I use the word risk-taking at all levels, for the facilitator and the coordinator of the project, the curator, but also the people who are making the works.
I think profoundly that was the was my question as well, which is that there are two questions. One is that the notion of risk-taking, it implies a notion of reflexivity on your condition, right? Now, if I'm being paid to spend some time to do an experiment, I can't see automatically the notion of risk. Risk is something, you know, I mean, there are always economic risks one takes in life which are of a different order than the kind of, the idea of risk-taking you're talking about, which is the notion of selfhood. You've seen that over time, perspectives may change, but the first, the kind of the starting of the idea of risk is something you're inserting into the landscape because of yourself. And I think that is, as everyone's saying, a kind of an important area that you have not really touched upon. I think that's where, and the idea of curating is risk-taking also then, or the notion of curating space or curating relationships or relations in terms of creating risk situations which begin with you and then have their kind of ripple effect is something which is really interesting here. And the second question is really the idea of stakeholders. I think I'm trying to figure out why I'm very uncomfortable with this word. I mean, there is a history that it has in development speak and NGO speak, and it has a certain kind of, in funding categories, it's got a big history of like, who are the stakeholders in this funding process kind of thing. But I think the part of the discomfort I have is that it's a very legible notion of stake, that my stake is X. You know, it's a very kind of concretized notion. Not the ideas of risk that we're talking about over here cannot be defined in X terms, right? The stake is X. The stake is my survival, for example, but which is also a very big word. So the word stake really becomes difficult for me to get to grips with, because it implies that if the stake remains the same, the people whose stakes are involved can change. For example, there are 10 stakeholders in a setup, right? Like if we set up something, we can say not co-owners, we can say stakeholders. But the notion of replaceability is there somehow. Maybe I'm just thinking a lot, and maybe someone can think this better than me right now, but I'm trying to understand my discomfort with that and how this notion of stakeholder speaks to the profound idea of risk that is being invoked, which is much more than kind of stake that can be delineated as X or Y. It's more than that.
Can you clarify?
I fail to understand the notion of risk taking. But let me just say one thing in response to the reason I don't use the word stakeholder, and actually I was unaware that it was a jargon term in other walks of life. The reason it rings a bell with me in a sense, and in the same terms as usership, is that usership has emerged as a relatively powerful form of political subjectivity in recent years, because people have formed themselves in very informal, loosely bound groups only on the basis of the specific type of knowledge which they have based on their usership, their common usership. So people in people using public services, for example, have turned against the expert culture which organized them in a certain way and said, no, we are the users of the medicines that we're taking. We are drug users. We know something about drugs that no doctor can tell us. And because doctors were merely there to inform the legislators about whether yes or no it should be legal or illegal. The people who use the systems of incarceration, for example, have spoken out as users of prisons. It seems very paradoxical, but and they're able to do it because they are not afraid to hide their interests. I mean, self-interest is not a bad thing. In fact, it's a very important thing. Owners have always done it. Laborers did it when they, that was the proletariat, right? Based on your relationship to the means of production, you could speak out. And users do it based on their specific relationship to goods and services. And I think stakeholders do, but a user has something at stake. And if I say, for example, I'm a user of art, like sometimes I talk about art in such a way that people say, Steve, why don't you stop talking about art and think of a new word, you know, and how much I like new words. But I say, no, that's a word I like to use. And I use it. So I make a particular use of that word. I make a particular use of everything that is designated or connoted by that word. So there's a case for a shift and a broadening and so on. But it's because I have a stake in it. But I don't perceive that in saying that, or I don't really perceive in anything about this fascinating example the notion of any real risk.
There's another aspect that actually, you know, from the discussion that, you know, comes to my mind is in terms of risk as well as user. The risk in terms of the community that, and I think, you know, another word that's really important in the discussion is the notion of intervention. The moment you intervene into a certain community and you
think you can, you know, make certain changes, whether it's some kind of material change or it's, you know, you, whether it's a Naga shawl which, you know, you're commodifying and selling into the mainstream market, or it's a ritual which people, the use for the ritual is completely, you know, a different, in a different context. But if you make it a tourist festival, what happens? So I think the risk from that point of view for the community itself is huge. That, I think, is something that also needs to be looked at when you, you know, as an NGO or as a development, within the development model, go into a particular space or a community and try to work. So I think those are things also that really, you know, are really, really problematic from that point of view.
I find it very strange to talk about stakeholders and communities, because for me, a participant is to a community, but a stakeholder is to a network. And I think what the project is essentially doing for me is not really building communities, because the communities already exist, but helping them in networking with different kind of places and structures, which is possible, and that's why risk-taking becomes actually easier. Because you're no longer making an intervention, but you are entering as a part of that network, one of the nodes within it. And so that any risk which is either at the level of self or at survival or at economy actually gets distributed across the entire network, so that each node within the network has equal stake in terms of sustaining it. So that it's no longer the responsibility of either the interventionists or the community members, but the entire then range of participants or actors or stakeholders that you want to kind of bring into that network. So I think we are moving into a new kind. For me, this was very interesting because it is actually a networking project. And so, Vishal, I'm not very sure if it's the same as your project, which I think is a community-oriented project, but theirs is more a networking project. I would like to make that distinction.
I think, actually, if I have any criticism of the project is the lack of risk. I think by distributing this risk and not owning it, you sort of shared the responsibility in a way.
But
and
sustainability, that can't be a critique. A distribution of risk equally over each stakeholder in that particular network is sustainable.
No, but they have not asked for it, right? It's been, so you as an interventionist are like saying like, let's participate in the risk, and you convince them, right? But the thing is, I mean, a lot of community interventions tries to dilute that by, like, rather than saying, and sticking to ethical things, and it should be good for everybody. I like when people actually cheat the communities and actually doing something which you really want, and then you claim it, and you say, I did it because of such and such reasons, and you do it in a transparent way, so there are questions, then you can answer it. And then your limitations or the premise you started with is can be questioned and asked. So, I mean, it need not be usable things. Like, I mean, a cart need not be made into a table. It could be made into a frivolous, abstract, like, thing. And there are so many recycled things are made into bizarre toys which have no use value at all, for example. And I think the more you push that, you know, coming to what you're saying, how shadow is not such a bad thing, and actually Stephen actually has written about how people choose to remain in the shadows to preserve those values exactly, which is like it allows you to find new ways to do things. So in fact, if you don't sort of publicize it so much and let it become a street thing and slowly it creeps up on people, it may be a more drastic strategy, because it will be like, you know, sort of more rooted, and then people will notice it without the documentation having to be brought to them, because it's already transformed the space in a way, you know. You know, so yeah.
Yeah, I like to answer Nancy's question about what do we get risk, but we don't see this as a risk. At all, but what do we get? We get to learn other people's practice, right? In a sense that we expand our curatorial ideas in our own role. So this is what we learned. But having said that, I think it's interesting that the whole notion of stakeholders to network kind of frame of mind is that we slowly thought about we are not like artists going into somebody else's community and do things. we are artists taking our steps to some others people and then forming our communities together. So the craftsmen and the seamstresses and the school kids are all in one community led by this project flag. You see what I mean? So this is why we call ourselves community museum projects. So each project has a project flag that coordinates in a way the community interactively. So this is the museum as method metaphor, as we had said earlier.
One short one. I thought you were actually quite protective of them because you promised them a certain remuneration, and it often happens if you have a nice enough grant, then you would like to share because they're also putting in so much valuable time. But ideally, I think you would like that they would be convinced by just your idea to do it and for no remuneration, or because they believe that it will get them some form of remuneration. It need not be just directly monetarily, but prestige, visibility, or which may ultimately transform into
remuneration, because for instance we put the shop address and telephone number in this publication, and after we distribute this publication, they receive a lot of commission. I mean, so in a sense, economically, they really become something of their own interest, to like the card making couples. They are some, of course, a lot of people tries to call them and tailor make this card or furniture with their recycled practices. So I think this, and this practices has been going on for 50 years since they had originally developed it. But now the Hong Kong government is always talking about recycling, but only on a very abstract level, and didn't recognize this like local street level recycling process at all until we publicize it.
I think then in that way it's a seed, and then you just show one example, and if they take the actual learning from the example and not just the direct following what you've told them, it might be they start inventing new things because it's a click, and that's when it becomes like an art project than like a developmental social good project.
I think right now, although it's already 2 years ago that we initiated this project, we are still in the very initial stage. So as far as risk-taking is concerned, I think all of us are working as a kind of extracurriculum activities. That means all the designers, all the facilities is included, and also the craftsmen, they are doing the things they are used to do on one hand. And they use some time of their working time to work on this kind of project. So it's because we are very aware that these craftsmen are using their working time to do this, so that we try to minimize the risk in that.
Back to Stephen's question about clocking time.
Yeah.
It goes back to Stephen's question about public time. I mean. We are all working. I'm working as a full-time professor, and everybody has their own job. But other than their job time, now they are interviewing another dimension of time, which is a volunteering kind of time, which draws publicity or whatever, making a kind of social statement to the city, I think. So,
one more word. I think I just want to follow King about this community formation issue. I think this case is particularly interesting because we're forming a new community. We're not just to reinforce or upholding an old community, which is most NGO would like to do in the old district. But yeah. So because we are introducing previously compartmentalized partners, like designers, like business. So we're trying to build this connection. And also to reframe it, sometimes is we try to present this case in, for example, business innovation conference. Because this is exactly what they are not seen as, the craftsmen, as an innovation business. Because they keep on, what I didn't tell you because it's a kind of a very tedious detail, but they keep on improving their design over the last 50 years. So this is something that is, this business innovation doesn't happen only to those so-called creative industry.
The question that Stephen has raised, and I think it's an interesting one, what is the relationship between risk and curating? And I think it's something, if we're not to talk about the details of the project, but there was a phrase you used, curating social relations. Now, social relations is a different order of thing than saying we're putting people together when we're, risk is, of course, the idea of fear that something will go wrong, but risk is also the idea of uncertainty. There's that is also a meaning of risk, not just that something, the fear of losing something, but the fact that this is an uncertain, precarious condition. And I think when you take words like social relations and curating, I don't know, it seems to me that it's packed full of things. I mean, because social relations are something that, if you are saying I'm making new connections between things that already exist, it is an unpredictable configuration. You do not necessarily know what's going to emerge. And that, I think, that's not something that very often people will say that they're curating social relations. And I just wondered how one could think through that and the relationship with risk, as he's asking.
I think two things which is coming to my mind, I think in relation to your project and whole idea of this art craft kind of politics. For that, I think this whole this Nehruvian vision is also whole idea of Nehruvian vision is also what we're talking about. This I would like to say that the whole political stakeholder is one of the first kind of a position of a curator which he took of certain areas of probably Northeast and some part of India where he employed a lot of anthropologists in order to understand certain communities which he don't understand, and they try to understand those communities through these artifacts. Okay, so it's like it become like identity markers for, and I think it's a quite an old project. For the first design school in India, like where we are trained, it's like this. Yeah, that is also a kind of a culmination of this idea of bringing back the craft into the forefront, not like the whole idea of high low and kind of situation. It's like probably I don't know. Most of you must be knowing this whole under this manifesto, or it's called India Report by Charles Ames, on the basis of which the National Institute of Design was set up, and the first prerogative of that institute is to revive the craft and things. But what I see behind it is also a kind of a tool to understand. Like sometimes what really happens, what Sonal is also saying, is that Naga shawl become more important to understand those people rather than trying to understand. These are primarily very anthropological search, or kind of, I would say, in kind of a way of curating this kind of diversified kind of people. It's called either Naga, it's Maite, or it's a Khashi, or even Kond. So it's like very Elwin. It's like if you see most of his books, it's like and he talks about people. It ends up talking about the artifacts or its use value or. But very interestingly, what he actually told, but nobody really understood what he said about craft, that he said, I think it's really pointless going to, I'm talking about a traditional craft, it's no point in going and intervening, because when you intervene, you really change the process of that product itself. So because you're turning into a kind of thing to bringing back to your society or that through that global circulatory systems. So most of this, I think, what has been happening for the last 50 years is that this problematic of, you know, craft object and this problem of identities, which is creating between, misunderstood identity becomes like the other side of the craftsman. I don't know whether I'm clear. Am I clear? Or what I'm trying to say is like the craft. It becomes like the other side of the identity. It's like the object. The reductionist. Yes.
If I'm right, it's not the anthropological like endeavor to preserve. Rather, it is to activate it. To dynamize it. So
I think
that it stays.
To
it's
develop,
not,
to preserve.
It's an anti-museum in a sense, because it's not preserving anything, but it's what is preserving actually in the museum is the ethos.
I think we believe in order to preserve it, we have to develop it. That's our belief.
In
order to preserve it, we have to develop it.
Just to add to... I'm happy you spoke about the agenda behind these design schools. Also about how, in a way, Nehru sort of virtually curated, especially the Northeast, via Barrier Elvin, where, in a way, the artifacts were privileged more than the people and the living communities. But another thing to add to this is that these design schools ultimately did not benefit the craftspersons. They benefited the designers, who then only went into styling luxury products. Yeah? And in fact, Dashrath Patel, who was one of the founder members of these design schools, has actually critiqued this. Yeah. Because, and therefore he started Sevagram and other projects where he worked with Dalit craftspersons. So again, the idea is that, of course, I mean, in the original vision, there may have been a problem, but we also need to re-emphasize the need to work in collaboration with craftspersons and look into their conditions. Just because it began in this artifactual anthropological naming project doesn't mean that the conditions of the craftspersons has changed, or it's something that you can then forget about. So therefore you have somebody like Dashrath Patel, founder member, who then actually critiques that whole project, which I'm sure you know more about because you're part of that.
Getting back to the gangs, and I think we have a tacit agenda in getting Sinha in somehow, like, you know, me and Rika. The point is that in this whole thing, it's just a matter of framing, and in some frame, in some ways, not deframing, but reframing as well. You draw the camera back. I mean, there's a connection which is coming in this whole talk about risk in curating. You curate social relations. Now, if I take the camera back and I say you're curating life, you know, somebody's life, then immediately the stakes of what you're doing changes, because the number of variables that then you have to take into account, which relates to what Nancy is saying, the whole critique of the anthropological project has been that it has only seen relations, you know, productive relations, and therefore what is necessary for the productive processes, what is absolutely necessary for extracting a certain kind of surplus labor from even a certain kind of craft traditions and using it in a developmental logic, you know. But the moment you position, you take the camera back and you say it's life, then I think risk is bound to come in. At that very moment, the way you look at things will have to change, because then every aspect of somebody's life becomes important. It's no longer a social relationship, it is a life that you're curating. Now that's one thing that needs to be taken into account, which in some ways has this connection inside my head at the moment with what we are doing at the moment is the project that you are doing, for example, and what we are doing here. Now, if I'm to answer somebody like Paolo Verno, who's insistently talking about making work of leisure time, I mean, is there that element in both these processes? Like what you're doing is that, and what Stephen was saying, that I keep working all through the day because there are various time zones that we are looking at, and you're putting a developmental spin to what you're doing in your free time with the craftsmen, and what we are doing here having a very strict lexical agenda to this project. Is this part of that? Again, it's a matter of focus. You know, if close why we are doing something useful, but the moment we take the camera back and we're looking at life, then there are questions which are raised. I mean, and usership and all these terms then start to take on a different meaning, because if you're talking about life, then Verno's logic of what we are doing, well, if Verno asked us his questionnaire, maybe we would fail. I mean, we would end up proving that we are exactly doing what he says is making leisure time into work, you know, in chasing lexical terms, in chasing, you know, a certain kind of... I'm a bit, you know, there's a certain connectivity between all this, which I would like that we discuss further. I mean, as to the practices, curatorial practices, risk-taking, what are the stakes in terms of our, you know, what at what distance are we keeping the camera? That's a stake for a filmmaker, you know, that's the strictest stake that one can have. And that changes the entire logic of what one shows or what one sees at the end of the day. Just querying. I mean, I'm just. These are things that are coming up as we are speaking.
I think another thing which is coming to my mind, even what Shuddha and Monica and I think you guys just before the tea break, was basically the whole idea of, you know, use of this ambiguous entity, which we very comfortably we ignore most of the time. You know, like. This whole thing of dictionary or lexicon versus manuals, I think it's quite interesting to see when we talk about spectator, user, and all kinds of things. The most interesting thing which I think in recent few years which I read in this, I know that's what, looks like a manual, I think it's Lev Manovich, Language of New Media. And the most interesting part is his prelude. It's just a description of Jigar Vertov's Man with the Movie Camera. So it's quite an it's quite an ambiguous project of looking, why he has put that, the whole idea of introduction to ambiguity, starting something somebody's looking at daily life, and it's, I don't think at that time in the thing was that film was not really looked at something which is useful or something which is very direct. It's kind of, I don't know which, what kind of film 2.0, film 3.0 category did still. It was seen in different things. I think it's also have a very interesting connection with the idea of digital and its whole idea of reproduction of life and what even Kaushik is saying, the curating life. And I think there is a sense of ambiguity which need to be brought inside this conjecture between lexicon and manuals, because I think we're in between to right now. You know, I think that's.
It's partially to take off from what you're saying, but I've been thinking this while listening to your very fascinating project and listening to all the other interventions. While I was looking at what you're doing, the person I was remembering most of all is Marcel Duchamp. Because it's the whole ethic of taking an object and transforming the way we look at it by framing it in a different way. So in a sense, it's almost, I mean, a project such as yours, and there are many other such projects, and I would even argue even what Vishal has been doing, is in a sense a direct descendant of the surrealist agenda of creating strangeness where we assume familiarity exists. Defamiliarizing or inserting a certain estrangement. Now, and it's interesting to think the consequences of that. When Duchamp introduces a urinal into a gallery exhibit, he's asking a certain set of questions about the way in which museums produce value. Museums are not the only institutions in the world. And I take it... I take your project of like a demuseumized museum quite seriously, because I think it's a really interesting assumption. But the idea of community, the idea of an NGO is also an institution. And I think that while in the art world we are by now, because of our habitual skepticism about the art world itself, quite prepared to be questioning of the institutional canons of museums and art histories, we sometimes trade that skepticism the moment we step outside the art world. In a sense that the institutional certainties of the idea of community building or the idea of social participation, the idea of networking, these are all translated automatically as good things. And by and large, they are. But if we ask, what are we doing as artists? What level of affirmation or estrangement are we producing by the way in which we take our, by the way in which we make our moves? I'm very curious to know, for instance, about the history of projects that are deliberately set out to disrupt NGO agendas, you know, which have this quite clear this thing. We will make life more difficult for anyone to do anything. And it's an interesting, I'm setting this up sort of provocatively, but I think it's also an interesting proposition to think about when examining the relationship between ourselves, our work, and institutional canons, of which museums are only one aspect. And just as museums and art history assumed for itself a natural civilizational value, which 20th century and contemporary art has actually destabilized, perhaps it's also possible for us to think of the other natural civilizational values of things around us that we might sometimes also turn our skeptical attention to. I mean, it's just a...
I think the notion of the institutionalized NGOs and other practices are somehow a kind of realization for us as well, because when we participate with these NGOs, they still we are now developing this kind of language to communicate by matching designers with social workers, and somehow that is hard because they are looking for a different kinds of outcome at the in its current models. But now, because by holding workshops and inviting both parties to develop work together, now we are starting to develop a kind of language that they could communicate how the give and take of the aesthetics as well as the social welfare dimensions, right? So I think we are still learning on that.
We won't use the term, or we don't have the thought about destabilizing someone. Okay, but there's always a kind of a contest of about the representation of a certain project between us and the NGO sometimes. So it's not always working smoothly. For example, one example is last year we have an exhibition about the contents of refrigerators. Okay, so it's a collaboration between us and also Oxfam Hong Kong and also another NGO group who's concerned about the welfare recipients in Hong Kong. So on one hand, they said they want to have a new light about the welfare recipient. And then so when we do the research, we are not just, of course, out of the 24 households, two-thirds of them are actually from these welfare recipient households. But what we try to focus on is their wisdom in dealing with food and storage. Okay. So at the end, when the exhibition opens, it seems that the NGO, including Oxfam, they are unable to reframe the whole thing. So they talked when they do the guided tour, it's the same old story, the same old narrative that they have been using. That is, the welfare recipients are poor. They are they're people in need. So that's this kind of narrative. While we try to reframe the whole thing, throw a little light on these people. So there's always a contest.
Just to add one small sort of conceptual detail. The problem is not whether we wish to destabilize or stabilize, because I think those are all worthy intentions. To destabilize something is just as good for me as it is to stabilize something. The problem is that you may wish to stabilize, you may wish to affirm the work of the NGO, they might think you're destabilizing them. You may wish to subvert the work of the NGO, they might think you're doing the best thing for them. And I think this is the most interesting legacy of surrealism, is that the intention that we bring to the production of a work and the consequences of that work are not necessarily the same thing. And so much of all our work actually resides in the negotiation of the distance between what we want to do and what happens as a result of what we want to do. Right? So, I mean, what I'm again saying is that I always plea for a certain care in making any claim as to the sort of the all-encompassing certainty of what it is that we're doing. We may want to do whatever we like, but it may still have consequences that are completely unpredictable to us. And in our work, a little room for that uncertainty, if we keep in mind. I think it's better for our, I sleep better.
I think it's this kind of uncertainty that we could claim this is a kind of art form. Yeah. Otherwise, we could become a social worker, in a sense, right?
But even though we have this kind of even arguments with NGO, we're happy with that, because it's just a fair competition of claiming ownership of the project.
I was going to suggest that we take a second break, which we'll call a beer break, in my case.
And lunch.